A very good morning. It's 10 past 10. It's the weekend edition this Saturday morning. Busy programme for you coming up. We'll speak to Lifford author Darren Gallagher, who launches his new book this week. There's back to school nutritional advice for children. Lorraine Boyce is in studio to discuss health and fitness. We talk to the ex-head of Mountjoy, who wants Irish prisoners, the ability for them to be repatriated and to serve their sentences at home to be more streamlined. There's live music from Donegal musician Rainy Boy Sleep, and we have a special feature on the new pro-Gaza murals that have popped up in Strabane. That and much more coming up on the programme. Your texts, calls and comments on anything, always welcome. 086 77 00 555. You can text the programme, call us 074 91 25000, or if you wish to tweet, you can tweet me at Greg Hughes 2. And joining us in studio for the first part of the programme is broadcaster and journalist Mary Hart. A very good morning to you, Mary.
Good morning, Greg.
And we're going to have a look through the papers and reflect on some of the news of the week. And if there's anything you think we should be talking about at home or wherever you are today at work, 086 77 00 555 is the text line. Yvonne is waiting to take your call. How are you, Mary?
I'm fine, being up early on a Saturday morning, yourself.
Exactly. Well, I'm used to it now. This is my 7th or 8th week, so we thought, well, you know, it's about time we got Mary Hart. You're probably up at 7 o'clock every Saturday.
Of course I am, of course, even 6 if you really want to push it.
Exactly. What's caught your eye so far today,
well,
Mary?
Well, you know, I know... starting off with good news is a good thing to do, especially on a Saturday morning. Mm. And it's really, really nice to say that Mark English, who's won Ireland's first ever medal in the 800 metres at any major outdoor championship. And I don't know Mark English, but from what I gather, he is from Letterkenny. I actually watched him running the race last night on television. And it's great to see someone who, he's only 21. Mm. He did win bronze. So I would imagine that we're going to see an awful lot more of him. And well done to him, because it's lovely to see somebody achieving such a wonderful thing, and him being, you know, also a student. You know, he's obviously got a lot of other things on his plate as well, but that, you know, he is a great good news story for us this morning.
And you know, I really enjoyed
congratulations to him,
exactly,
and his family.
Congratulations to him and all his supporters. I just didn't have access to RT last night, and I was watching the race on the BBC, and I was expecting, you know, it to be, you know, I don't know what I was expecting, to be honest with you, but it was as if it was one of their own runners, and there was references to Letterkenny and his mom and dad and Letterkenny Gales, the football club he used to play with, and they had all his background and what have you. And it was really nice that the BBC focus of the coverage was on Mark, who is, by all accounts, too, listening to his after race interview. And as you say, he's only 21. Yeah. He's got the world at his feet, and it's fantastic, because
absolutely,
it was a really competitive race.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, what you say is they've obviously been watching him. You know, he's, you know, he was tipped. I mean, and he himself, I think, had said that he, you know, he was actually going maybe for gold and hoping for silver, but he got bronze, which is fabulous anyway. Mm. You know, I mean, that's great. He's, you know, he has got a lot more to offer in the future, I have absolutely no doubt. And yeah, it is encouraging to, you know, that, you know, somebody, we talk ourselves down so much in this country, you know, we're not capable of producing great athletes. And I know Patsy McGonigal, who's, you know, a very good old dear friend of mine, not old in any bad sense of the word, just I know
old
for
in
very,
the
very
nicest
many
possible
years.
Way, yeah.
And I recently was talking to Patsy about, you know, the up and coming championships that he's involved in. He's been a tremendous encouragement to young people and runners. And
it's astonishing
his
level. Sorry, Mary, I didn't mean to cut across you, but it's astonishing his level of commitment to it, isn't it? Because
absolutely,
he travels all over the place.
Yeah, he is a great inspiration to everybody. And one of the comments that Patsy did say to me was, you know, I see so many fabulous young people in this country, and we just don't have the money. We don't have the, you know, the encouragement, the financial backing to get them that bit pushed a bit further forward. And I mean, one comment, and this isn't in any way taking away from the GAA and the young people involved in Gaelic Games, but, you know, there are so many of those. They're all volunteers. And I suppose, it, you know, it is a voluntary organisation, and those young people are not professional, but they love GAA because they're at Gaelic games from a very early stage, and I suppose they put all their energies and their efforts into the GAA, which doesn't take them onto that international platform. So therefore, we do have fabulous and very talented and energetic sportsmen in the country, but they're in a
and women, Mary, just before I get
and
text
women,
out of it.
And women, of course.
But I know that, and we've had we've produced some of the finest middle distance runners ever.
Yeah, and the rugby team, the women's rugby team beating New Zealand. I know they were hammered to pieces then, when they came up against England this week. But however, they achieved something that and they're volunteers. Like they're not professional rugby players.
You made an interesting reference to Gaelic there too, because there's a difference there in that, Mark English would have a massive level of support, but at the end of the day, when he's warming up on that track, it's him.
Yes.
Gaelic football or soccer or football, that other football, it's a team sport, and you've got someone you can go over and speak to. I was watching him last night, and I was wondering, I wonder what goes through these people's heads. How do they mentally get, because he had tactics to run. He went off very quickly, or he criticised himself a little bit in the semi-finals because he thought he felt a little bit lethargic. But he knew tactically how he had to run this race, because that boss guy, the French guy, he went off really quick and he knew the poles would be strung. So, it wasn't just a case of head down and, arms
no,
going.
You've got to watch, got to pace yourself. And not that I am no runner, but I did watch, the long distance run with the women's I can't even remember the distance the last evening, and the Irish girl was in the middle, and she did exceptionally well, but she was pacing herself, and you watch that and you think, now she's a sprinter from what I gather, and she may have excelled at the very end of the race or towards the end of the race. Obviously it didn't happen, but congratulations to him, congratulations to everybody who's out. And I have to say, I suppose it also struck me this morning that I see so many, even this morning when I was coming in, driving in, so many people out walking early in the morning.
Huge, isn't it?
So many people nowadays training for, the 5Ks in local villages and towns, and the 10Ks. Letterkenny's going to have its first ever marathon. So we are getting into the, fitness regime here, and great and well done. My only negative in all of this is that I would like to think that the government would start to look at that and start putting money particularly into primary schools and into primary school fitness regimes, instead of academic, yes, and learning your ABCs and all of that is important, but it is equally important to have very good physical education.
Healthy bodies, healthy mind.
Yeah.
And we are going to be talking, funny enough too, and it's part of that, to Dr. Catherine Logan a little later, who's a nutritional manager with the National Dairy Council. And as I say, earmuffs, children, if you're listening, it is almost back to school time, but you've got at least a week.
Soon.
I feel so bad, really, because it's education.
It's
good.
Not bad. It's good.
Before
good.
We move on to, I want to mention Brendan Boyce, who finished 16th in the 50k race walk, which I think he actually had a personal best in that, if I'm not mistaken, too. Another Donegal athlete who did fantastic, and I'd say he'd be pretty delighted too with that positioning, because it was a proper world class field. So, two Donegal lads leading the charge. It's fantastic,
yeah,
isn't
no,
it?
Yeah, no, it's we've got of course we've got great roads to be running on. Well, sort of. Which brings me on.
If they could
to
just leave us some space to drive on them.
Well, I know it is dangerous.
No, I'm only joking.
And I do know that, people, and I know, like, often we are warned that when you are out walking the roads, that you walk on the opposite side to where the traffic is, so you can see the oncoming traffic. And also, people wear headphones, and I would worry about that, because you just don't. I walk the roads myself, and sometimes I just don't hear a car coming around the corner. So, you have to be, mindful that, you are in a danger zone when you're doing all of that. The next thing that struck me this morning, the Irish Times, basically I had a little bit of a giggle about this, because it says the minister, and this is our new minister, Anne Phelan, and she warns against out-of-town store outlets. Now, what's new about that? Mm. We all know about this. What I had the little bit of a giggle about was that she said, she's quoted in the Irish Times in an interview that she's done with the paper, saying, I've had many sleepless nights worrying about what we can do about villages. I'm wondering about that,
What is your take on that, Mary? Because, there is this argument that It is a competitive area. You know, it's the retail sector, the strongest survive. But then you do see this argument that town centres have been decimated because I think it's more of a concern when these shed stores and what have you are maybe, you know, 2-3 kilometres out of town.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's much of a problem as a problem if they're closer to the town. But how do you plan for that? Because it's a complicated one, isn't it?
It is complicated. I live in Riffel and I grew up, you know, in a town that was, you know, not always buzzing, which always had its ups and downs. Mm. It certainly survived during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, which was a huge impact, had a huge impact on border towns. Many of them just, you know, suffered very seriously from that because, you know, the traffic coming across, etc., and all of that. People from the south never came north to Donegal, and you know, we suffered as a result. However, Riffel did survive that. We had four banks eventually. We had Fruit of the Loom. We had a lot of interesting little shops down through that period. The town now has almost become a ghost town, and I've tried to figure out why has this happened. And one of the biggest impacts is that the banks closed their banks in Riffel, which I think is appalling. Every time I go into the bank, I have to now go, for instance, to Ballot Buffet. The two issues here. I know one of the issues that the minister is raising is these, you know, big shopping centres. But there's another issue as well. There are people, pen pushers, I would call them, in, let's say, central government and central organisations at the hierarchy, who are looking and saying, well, we can get rid of this area, we can get rid of this bank here, we can get rid of this department in a little small town, and get rid of this guard, the station here. They don't take in the big picture of what the impact of that is on that small town. There's nothing we can do. The conglomerates are going to come. They've always come. We've seen, we should have seen that what was happening in Britain, you know, way ahead of us. We've seen it happen in America. But the reverse is the case. What happens now, we should be looking at places like France. What happens there, you know? There are the Lidls and there are the big stores. We should be encouraging small homegrown shops that sell local produce, shops that sell jam, shops that sell crafts. These, you know, the local little small towns should be encouraged, but they have to be encouraged with finance.
Are you talking almost like a residential farmer's market? You know, what we see in a farmer's market, but, you know, in the centre of a town, in shops. People have driven through villages, as you've mentioned, that would have seen that type of thing. That's the way we need to diversify them.
I believe so.
But it needs
to get people to come
help.
In, you know, to encourage people to come in. You have to have some kind of a unique market. You have to have something that'll bring people to the small town, because people are, you know, as you say, you know, it is a economy driven by competitiveness. If you know, the conglomerates come in and they can sell things cheaper. Now, they are buying local produce, you know, the vegetables and a lot of those, like Lidl's and Aldi's, are locally produced, maybe not in Donegal, but they're possibly Sligo or near enough. So, you know, they're not entirely bad. They're also providing employment. So you can't completely rule them out. And in fact, a colleague of mine in the United States said, in their experience there, and they've done research into it, is that these organisations and big conglomerates actually provide more in terms of finance coming into the area than the smaller local shops anyhow.
Yeah, but it's kind of heartless too, to some extent. You know, I mean, it's great. We can be in our houses. We can leave our houses. We can avail of these great deals in these shops. But where's the spirit? Where's
Absolutely.
The heart of a town? Where's the community?
Yeah, and that's where we have to rethink what is that.
And if you look at the National Development Plan, to all intents and purposes, and then you look what's happening, as you've been mentioning, about garda stations, post offices and banks and rural pubs, which, you know, no one would condone drink driving, but the smoking ban and much more stricter drink driving laws have signalled the death knell for a lot of rural pubs. It does seem that the NDP, the National Development Plan, or the policy is to depopulate rural areas.
I'm not so sure that I would agree with you in terms of depopulate rural areas, because that is one of my bugbears. Because Eamon O'Keefe, the former minister for, I don't know what it was, rural affairs, but what now that this is called rural affairs, now this is a new title.
I think he had Gaeltacht in with that at the same time.
He claimed that and the ribbon developments, he claimed that you know, this, you could have planning across rural areas, so planning permission was allowed to cross the rural areas, which we see a huge amount of in Donegal, particularly over in Gweedore and places like Downings, where I'm not saying people shouldn't be building their houses, but the knock-on effect of that is that you are putting your populations, you're spreading them out. So the villages are disappearing because the people aren't living there. So if you're not living in the village, if you're not living on the corner or the edge of the town or the edge of the village where you have your schools, where you do have your post office, where you have your, you know, your pub, where you have your little restaurants, your little coffee shops, people then go elsewhere because they have no affinity to the town to which they're living close by to. And I see that in Rafoe, there is so much now outside town development. Now, I'm not saying that there should be no houses in the countryside, but there are those who, as they, I think the comment at the time was, there are those who are of the country and are those who are part of the country, and those who just come there, they sleep there, and but they don't, they're not
my
part.
Point B is, if I live in a rural area of Donegal, which I actually do as it transpires, if I live in a rural area of Donegal and my guard station's gone, my local school, where I want to send my children, has been closed down. There's no post office, no bank. And, you know, if I have to want to do anything, it's going to be 20, 30 mile drive. Then I'm being encouraged to move into the town. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Very well, Paul. Lovely to chat to you. What say you?
The situation, one of the major problems is whenever you go for planning permission within a town, to the legislation is very difficult. So it is, insofar as if you have disabled access or you have Part L, Part M, all of that there to obtain, it's impossible.
Is Paul, are you talking about a shop building or opening a shop in a town?
If you were to try now and even sort of change of use of premises within a town, the criteria has got so stringent that you need to have X amount of car parking spaces for the floor space of your premises.
Okay.
So the larger stores, it's easier for them to get actual the proper requirement and the proper legislation when they go onto a green field outside the village regarding parking, regarding your disabled access, regarding your energy requirements. And that is one of the reasons why they do move out of the town, because it's easier for them.
Yeah, because that, you know, that's quite interesting what you're saying, because I do know that in Rafoe we had an issue, you know, of a new development that didn't happen. But one of the planning demands at that time was that there would be underground car parking, and now the underground car parking was going to have to be right beside, you know, a very ancient and heritage zone in the town, so it wouldn't have made any sense to start digging up into a small village like Rafoe, you know, that you'd have to have underground.
But if you go to Donegal town, for instance, there was massive plans for retail development in the town there. You know, I know it's somewhat outside the town, but there was similar plans also for Buncrana. A lot of these didn't go ahead because of objections. So it's, you know, it's the people too, Paul, as much as it not as the legislation.
Yeah, but when a person objects to on board Clonala, they must have a rationale for objecting. So that proved the fact that there was something there that wasn't the proper requirement.
Yeah,
but regarding the other aspect of it, as you're well aware of, your underground parking, we have issues with flooding, so they're going to be a thing of the past too.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think, you know, that certainly, you know, what Paul says is absolutely right. There are too many regulations and laws putting people off developing in the local towns. And what we actually have, which we also should bear in mind, is when we have these small little garage supermarkets and small supermarkets in the local town, they are also huge conglomerates. They're not just, you know, the Spars and the Centras and, you know, whatever the others are. They're not small shops either. They are equally the same as the big conglomerates. So that, you know, those profits are still, but what they're doing is they're keeping local people in the town and, you know, in the area. But I do believe that, you know, this so-called plan, which is, you know, there's a very interesting article, you know, that in the Irish Times, part of the supplement, and it's, you know, can she fix it? Like, that's basically, a comment about can this new minister, you know, for rural affairs, can she fix rural Ireland? She'll not fix it in the lifetime of this government. And she's a bit late to be even appointed, as she says herself. You know, she's got basically, really, realistically, about 18 months to try and do something about the so-called, I didn't even know this 34-point CEDRA plan, which is to do with regenerating rural Ireland. And, you know, it does specify something like, in this, it says, well, for instance, there's no motorways in Donegal or Mayo. We don't have motorways. So people look at Ireland and they think, well, why would we, you know, jet up to Donegal. I don't agree where she also says we can't get, you know, the IDA, to, you know, we can't get the big Intels into rural Ireland. We, of course we can. Raphoe had Fruit of the Loom. They had 1,200 people there. The biggest problem for them, aside from their own issues, you know, in a global sense, you know, they had commented about, and also here in Owen Unify in Letterkenny, when there was a blip in the power outage here, when, you know, if the power went, you know, there was a flaw in the fabric. And so therefore the fabrics were no good. So for that reason, you know, you know, if you had a sewing machine going through, I'm not saying that that's the kind of, but if you were to have, you know, Intel or, you know, computer or even, you know, some of the call centres, and I have nothing against those, they can be small and in the areas, you need good service broadband, you need good service electricity.
Well, that's the infrastructure we talk about. Paul, from a council's perspective, can anything be done at that level, or does it require national policy?
It requires national policy, unfortunately. It can't be. You know, we're determined, as you're well aware of, regarding the one farm energy.
I mean, that's a cock-up, isn't it? That's ridiculous.
We're determined by national guidelines. We have to be derived from them first before we can bring in our development plan, and we can't go against national guidelines.
What is the point of the development plan then? Because, you know, the wind farms has highlighted the fact that, look, at the end of the day, councillors and council planners can make the decision, but on board Planala, they are abided by the national policy. So really, the county development plan is a moot document.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
You know, that's the problem that we are having. Like, we all of us have put in changes that we wanted to see, but they were you only seen the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, of course.
Overrun, you know, and that's
a lot of it's aspirational. Councillor Paul Canning, thanks so much for coming on the program. Moving on, what next, Murray Hart?
One of the stories that has hit everybody this, well, when I say it has hit everybody this week, people are familiar, you know, and surprised, Robin Williams, that, you know, the passing of Robin Williams from, you know.
And this is a very, very difficult area to discuss. I'm really conscious of that because, you know, some people, some national broadcasters that you would expect perhaps more of dropped the ball in terms of their coverage because, Robin Williams died by suicide, and what do you have to say on that, Murray?
Well, first of all, the man himself clearly suffered from many demons, and he was an alcoholic, and he had an addiction to drugs, from what I gather as well, and he suffered from deep depression. The Irish Times obituary has a half page obituary to him this morning, and one of the things that caught my eye about that is says that he had a privileged upbringing. He was a son of a Detroit car executive, and he grew up alone, very much alone. He grew up as a chubby young boy that caused him a lot of problems, and he ended up, as he has obviously described himself, saying that he used to play with 2,000 toy soldiers in an empty room, and that's what his upbringing was. So he was obviously, you know, had issues. That he died by suicide, that he had you know, a lot of demons, that's a tragedy. It's a terrible tragedy. But suicide is not the answer, as we all know. Suicide is, you know, generally a call somewhere in your head for help. He had been diagnosed with early stages of Parkinson's.
Now, just again, one important thing, which I have, just in relation to the Parkinson's, and I don't wish to break your flow. His wife released a statement where Parkinson's was referenced. The priority in that statement she released was about his depression and anxiety and the fact that he had been sober for quite some time. And the press, for some reason, ignored that and took out the Parkinson's, almost to some extent drawing a conclusion on that. And I wasn't really 100% happy with that because the wife, who knew him as good as anyone, wasn't drawing that conclusion. But anyway, sorry, Mary, carry
on. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been involved in you know, with the suicide groups in the north for many years, and researching, and I know, like, it's a very difficult subject to deal with, and there are people who suffer from very acute depression. Thankfully, there are drugs initially, and then there's an awful lot of help out there, and generally, it's sad when someone reaches a point that we know that next week Robin Williams would say, "My God, how did I get to that point?" If he had survived, he would be saying, "I should never have gotten to that, you know, that stage." And the research again of people that survived jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, that the information that they brought back is that those who did survive said once they jumped, they were sorry they jumped. You know, so, which is a terrible tragedy that you have. Yeah. It's a message that you need. You know, it needs to be
the biggest challenge, though. In the biggest challenge in dealing with depression, and as a society, for us to deal with it, and for a person to deal with it, is conversation and reaching out and seeking help. And it doesn't matter how much money you have, how successful you are, how downtrodden you are. Once depression takes hold, it's such a dark place. But if you reach out, if you have that conversation, as I say, it doesn't matter if you're a king or the complete opposite of it. As you say, the alternative to that realization, if you survive an attempt, is that, well, that's when you are engaging in help. So that really underlines the importance of talking, isn't it, Mary?
Absolutely. I heard a great interview that was done many years ago on RTE, and I think it was actually Gay Byrne that was doing the interview, so it was quite a while ago. And it was a young guy who said, like, he had taken an overdose, and he could hear them saying, you know, we're losing him, he's going to die. He survived, and he said, "My life had become a stage where I was walking on one side of the river and everybody else was standing on the other side of the riverbank, and I was shouting across at them that I need help, but nobody was hearing me." And he said, really what was wrong was I wasn't telling them. I wasn't actually, my voice wasn't carrying to them because I wasn't telling them. Mm-hmm. So it really is, you know, to get the message into people's head that you have got to tell, you have got to speak it, you have got to, and once you start doing that, that's you're starting to move into, you know, an area where you can be helped.
But
and
depression can be so, sometimes it's so irrational, and it's very difficult to rationalise the irrational, because, you know, when you're in that place. The thing about the how this story was handled, though, we haven't really progressed in any way. I mean, you were hearing commentators that were, you know, his struggles with depression and anxiety. You had commentators saying, yes, but when he played his serious roles, you could see how he was able to draw on that terminology being used, like, well, now he's at peace. All of these are things that the Samaritans would very strongly suggest that you don't say, because it in some way glorifies it or
Absolutely.
Justifies it.
Yeah.
I still think we've a ton of work to do as a society and in the media, really, to address that and take it more seriously.
Well, I mean, one of I was brought into the suicide team in Derry as a media advisor, you know, sometime back in the late 90s. Mm. And they have done an awful lot of research. It was the Foyle Trust in Derry. And one of the things, I attended a lot of conferences and a lot of workshops from a media point of view. And the glorifying, or in fact, you know, the speaking of, as we are doing this morning, should be discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, even during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, when somebody was shot, we would say, you know, a man has been shot. But if somebody, you know, shot themselves, you know, all we would say was a shotgun was found, no crime is suspected. That was it. The funeral.
But people are clever, though. That's
nothing,
implied.
There was not. Yeah.
Yeah. But so we need. So that's not really fixing it.
But what it was, but there was no more mention of it. It never came back into
the news.
And is
that good or bad?
It is good that it's not. What we need to talk about.
So
is
then,
mental health.
How do we exactly? That's precisely what I was going to say. You know. You can't beat around the bush either, can you? Because we need to know what we're talking about. There's this controversy at the moment with the short. I know there's different views on it, but we've got these short death certs that are going to, some would argue, skew the figures as it relates to how someone died, whether they died, you know, whichever way they died. So, I mean, we don't want to bury it either,
no,
do we?
The taboo of suicide should be encouraged is what the general thinking behind it is.
And what's your thinking?
I absolutely agree. Okay. And I think the media have been very irresponsible, especially tabloids. And really, we have to have a rethink. And I know the NUJ, part of our programme, went through the NUJ in London to ask that there was, and which it did result in, a booklet being issued. And I bet, do you have a booklet here? You probably...
Yeah, we have the Samaritan guidelines.
You know, it was basically how the media should handle suicide. Because a big factor in it is copycat. and clustering, and you know it's prompting, and that's wrong. And now Father Troy in Belfast, who had to deal with an awful lot of young group of young men over a very small period of time, Father Troy said to me, "What I wanted to do was to say at those funerals, I only want the parents and immediate family at the funerals. I do not want to see anybody else. Nobody is allowed into the church."
And for God's
sake,
just,
he said, "I couldn't do that because," he said, "I would be vilified."
And from a society perspective, we need to get rid of these Facebook pages that tend to pop up and what have you. Look, we'll move on from that. I just want to give a couple of numbers, though, because the importance is talking and reaching out. And if you have been affected by what we've been talking about, there are so many people that are prepared to listen to you and help you through it. You can call the Samaritans on 1850 60 90 90. That's 1850 60 90 90. Or if you wish to speak to GROW, another fantastic organisation, 1890 47 44 74. People that have know exactly how to deal with these type of things are waiting to take your call and to help you. So we have those numbers here if you require them. Final piece, Mary, the time has gone so quickly.
Final piece, I suppose.
It's not a positive, is it?
No, Cliff Richards. You know, this is again.
This is another one, isn't
this
it?
Is the media. In fact, it's the tabloids, the general, the other newspapers really have just buried it, but have not given it the prominence that the tabloids, as you would expect, have given. And what I was interested in says Cliff Moore call to the cops. But it doesn't say what the calls are. The calls could be about anything.
All right, well, let's break it down, Mary. Cliff Richard has been named. He's been hung, drawn and quartered on social media for the last 6-7 months. Anyone who's on Twitter and follows certain people, and I don't mean about anybody, that they would know that Cliff Richard, there were allegations against him. Now, someone tipped the media off that this house was going to be searched, and it kind of meant that this could come out into the public domain. Should Cliff Richard be named in the press?
I actually don't believe so.
Then these people that come forward in other cases, after they've been publicised, they build a stronger case, and the person who done something very bad, not talking about Cliff Richard in this case, is that not a strong argument to name them so as that other people can come forward and strengthen the case if this person, or a person, not Cliff Richard, has abused a child, for instance?
Well, the police have said that thanks to the media, people have come forward, but they haven't said what, you know, the people have come forward with. To start with, I personally, I think we need to look seriously at when people are wasting police time, because there are a lot of people who it's in their interest to, to make us, there are so many fruitcakes out there.
I can make an allegation against you. And I could have ulterior motives. I'm protected by law. I'm not named. You're out in the public.
Absolutely.
And that's really the nuts and bolts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, the law may need to be looked at in a way that, because of the social media aspect now of, when somebody is, like as a journalist, my training was when the police would go in and arrest somebody, well, we never named the person until they were charged.
No, of course, yeah.
But nowadays you're charged before you're even arrested.
And there is that race to the bottom. If the Sun put his name out, the Star have to put his name out, the Mirror has to put his name out, and then the tabloids, they'll get his name out. They'll bury it 2 or 3 pages in, but let's face it, they're in it too,
And and this morning, one of the issues that's floating around too in the main newspapers, and I see Gay Byrne as well, and I, being a former BBC journalist, there are big question marks over how come the BBC, before anybody else knew about this, now the police say they didn't tip the BBC off, but they responded to the BBC to a phone call they received. I would suspect what has happened here is, I know that, it's a mansion and it's a large complex or whatever. There could quite possibly be somebody in there who has tipped the BBC off privately from that complex.
But
seen the police coming in here and then
But
the
to
BBC
wrap it up, you think Cliff Richard should not have been named?
No, I don't think so. No, absolutely not. The man, guilty, if I'm not saying he is even remotely guilty, but even if he was guilty, that's a job for the investigating officers of a crime, and he will have due process, and if he's guilty, then he will suffer the consequences.
And if he goes,
and if he's innocent, then he won't have suffered any...
So then, for instance, but you're happy if his name would be released, say, for instance, if it were to go to trial?
Yes,
and
charged. Of course, if you go to
trial. Because it's speculation at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, no. If somebody is charged with an offence, and you know that's, you know, after that, but somewhere in there is lost is that you're innocent until proven guilty, and the tabloids have suddenly, well, not suddenly, but in the last, you know, maybe 15, 20 years, have become the juries and the trial judge of. Famous people. Now, famous people are fair game to a point because that's what they are, and they you know, they live within the media and they live within the press. But it has moved on to a very nasty stage because, as you say, and I was unaware of the Facebook allegations and all of those rumblings.
Well,
the
exact allegations that came to light yesterday have been made in social media, and Cliff in his. Cliff, in some of his comments, has referenced that he knew it was there. Mary Hart, we have run out of time. It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you so much for coming in on a Saturday. And hopefully we'll be able to enjoy your company again in the not too distant future. But time is against us. We don't have 3 hours like the midweek guys. Mary Hart, journalist and broadcaster. A pleasure to speak to you on some really interesting topics. And thanks for discussing them with us. If you have anything you wish to say on the Cliff Richard aspect, do you agree with Mary Hart? Is he entitled to his anonymity until such time, at the very least until he's charged? Get in contact with us now. Text the programme 086 77 00555, or you can call Yvonne right now on 074 91 25000. Yvonne is waiting to take your call. We'll be back with more on the Weekend Edition with Greg Hughes after this break. Keep the texts coming, 086 77 00555 or 074 91 25000. We're talking back to school nutrition now. If you have a question on that, get in contact with the programme. We have a specialist, nutrition manager with the National Dairy Council, Dr. Catherine Logan, to discuss this. If you have a question for Dr. Logan, get in contact with us now. Catherine, good morning.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Very, very good. In my preamble a little earlier on, I have so much sympathy for those who realise their summer holidays are coming to an end. But they'll be glad to get back to see their friends, I'm sure. And responsibility as parents and guardians is to give them the best start to the day and the best energy boost as the day goes on. And we do that, I suppose, with nutrition.
Absolutely. Nutrition plays a very important role in our health and well-being, and I suppose how we actually perform both, I suppose, mentally and physically throughout the day. Thankfully, there's guidelines in terms of reaching a healthy, balanced diet and the nutrients that we should be consuming. And obviously, that will change for various stages of your life. So parents out there who've got young children who are going off to school for the first time, their, I suppose, considerations and then their concerns would be very different from a parent who has a teenage son or daughter. And then again, if they're very active, if they're studying very hard and leaving cert or junior cert year, all those types of things need to come into play. And again, the foods, the nutrition, the type of decisions that you make in terms of your diet and lifestyle have a huge impact on all of those. So as I say, we do have guidelines here. What I would suggest is that all parents get familiar with the food pyramid, be aware of the various food groups. We've got our breads, our cereals, pastas and rice in one group. We've got our fruit and vegetables. We've got our milk, cheese and yogurt. And then we've got protein sources like meat, fish, eggs, pulses. And then, of course, you've got your fats, and then which are essential fats in terms of essential fatty acids are needed in small amounts. And then you've got your treat food. So,
well, just to simplify it, because, you know, there were statistics released either this year or last, well, they're released annually in any case, that showed a shocking amount of children go to school on an empty stomach, having eaten nothing at all. So let's start with a breakfast. Obviously, we can't go through all of it and what have you, but just to highlight for you, what would be a good start to the day for a young person heading off to school?
Well, I suppose first and foremost, having a breakfast is essential. It is very important that people either leave with a breakfast or else have something with them to consume whenever they reach either school or work. So having a breakfast is firstly very important. In terms of what food you should be eating, there are so many choices. And again, depends on your lifestyle. A high fibre breakfast cereal with milk, the ideal opportunity for children if they've got the time to sit down and have that, and maybe some toast along with that. A fruit juice, a pure fruit juice as well, is a nice accompaniment to a breakfast for a child.
And you want slow release foods, don't you, that sort of release the energy throughout the course of the morning, because especially if you're a very young person and you have to concentrate, and I know from having done manual labour in the past and then having done a programme like this, you know, having to concentrate so much, it almost takes up more of your energy than, you know, other stuff that I've done in my past. So I can understand then for a child how, you know, they need that energy to throughout the course of the morning for the learning process.
The high fibre, the whole grain options, they're the ones you should be, I suppose, routinely eating. So unsweetened high fibre breakfast cereals, that can be ready to go or ready to eat cereals. It could also be porridge made in milk. And especially now, I suppose, the summer's coming to an end, we're coming into the autumn, maybe a cereal with warm milk as well. So look at the various options. And as I say, the whole grain, the whole meal breads, have them toasted.
Well, this caller says, my 3-year-old starting play school in 2 weeks. She won't eat cereal anymore for me in the morning. She will eat cheese on toast and some fruit for breakfast. Will this be enough to get her to snack time and also help her learn? So the child's preference at this stage is cheese on toast and some fruit in the mornings. Does that tick the boxes?
That combination sounds actually really healthy.
Okay.
When you think about the fact that you've got your carbohydrate source from the bread, again, I'd be advising to try and get the child to be used to eating the high fibre options. Now, smaller children, in terms of the higher fibre options, it could make them feel fuller. So perhaps, you know, introduce it gradually, because you want to ensure that they're still getting enough food throughout the day. You don't want them filling up on all high fibre options, but it is important that they get used to those sorts of choices. So I'd be trying to get those into the breakfast if possible. Cheese, again, a source of calcium. In terms of children, milk and yogurt, again, are very important sources of calcium. Very young children perhaps don't have the capacity, due to the small body size, to consume, I suppose, large volumes of fluid. So cheese is very important with that regards.
And I heard Catherine, to cut across there, but I heard also too that there, you know, a lot of parents have low-fat milk in the house, but my understanding is now that up to around 6 or 7, full-fat milk is better for children.
In terms of the guidelines there, up until the age of 2.
2, is it?
Semi-skim milk can be introduced from 2 once your child has eaten a healthy, balanced diet.
So what then...
Skim milk, definitely not before 5 years of age.
Not before 5. And then what can we send to school with our children?
So in terms of the school days, I say there's so many considerations here. Let's start off with the primary school. They tend to have a small break. So ensuring that you have, say, a drink there, for example, water or milk would be the best choices. But then some other options would be maybe a whole fruit or a mixed fruit salad, some crackers and cheese, maybe a yogurt with the fruit salad, or maybe a pot of berries. Coming into the winter again, maybe a thermal flask of vegetable soup, homemade preferably, yogurt, maybe chopped vegetable sticks with a nice hummus dip or a yogurt dip. So we're talking those sort of healthier options. Wholemeal scones, again, are very useful. Crisp bread and crackers and things like that, again, they will last in the lunchbox as well. So that's always important to consider, food hygiene and safety. So, as I say, they're nice options for the small break. Have a lunch and then a healthy snack, have a drink and a healthy snack to go with it. And as I say, if you start off your day with a breakfast and foods we discussed, and then they have the snack at that time, that definitely, if you look at the options we discussed there already, Greg, you're talking about well on your way to 5 a day, 3 portions of milk, cheese or yogurt, or 5 if you're between the ages of 9 and 18, so you're well on your way there. Again, you're getting your intake and your energy from the potatoes, breads, pastas and rice groups. So we are, consider all those choices and consider the variety within them. So if you're planning the small break Monday to Friday, don't always have the same fruit, for example, if you're going for the fruit option. Maybe mix it up with a banana or an apple or the fruit salad. Perhaps throw in the vegetable soup for another day. So consider the variety. I suppose what maybe you should consider as well is, what would you like to eat? You know, for your 11s at work or mid-morning snack, basically, you don't always want to face the same options each day. So try and look at the variety.
You talk to them. Sorry, I beg your pardon, Catherine. You know, mums and dads are probably more busy now than ever, probably both having to work and what have you. But a lot of what you're talking about can be pre-prepared. So with preparation, you can plan out a lot of that week, can't you?
Absolutely, Greg. Like, planning will ease your life considerably when it comes to back to school, and especially if you have, I suppose, more than one child as well. Just taking a bit of time at the weekend to plan the meals ahead. That goes for the school day and then the dinner or the tea that's going to be served that night. So, yeah, stop and think. And I literally would advise parents to actually plan out each day in advance. As I say, a huge chunk of time will be saved during the week. Stress and anxiety will all be reduced. So if you take the time of the weekend, even talk to the children, talk to other members of the family and see what foods that they will enjoy, what could be included in the lunchbox. Perhaps something could be prepared if you've got an hour or two of the weekend and freeze it. In terms of, we talked about variety, perhaps you don't want to give them sliced pan bread every day. Buy a couple of bread rolls in bulk, maybe tortilla pockets as well. You can freeze those sorts of foods. So sit down at the weekend and make sure that you have, for example, the foods in the house for the small break, what you're planning to have in the lunchbox, and then also consider the dinner that evening. It definitely relieves stress and anxiety throughout the week.
And that's what we want.
Midweek, and then if you have more time to do a shop in midweek, then have a look at topping up the cupboard then at that stage.
Dr. Logan, thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Not at all. Thanks,
Greg. Thank you very much indeed.